This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Philip Haberkern from Boston University is back to talk about the introduction to Ygritte. And, if that's not tantalizing enough, we talk a lot about Song of the Winter Rose, which has all kinds of theory crafting around it. After my conversation with Phil, I get to ask a listener question to Professor Dorsey Armstrong, who's an expert on Arthurian legend. So stick around for that. One last thing. The ad break will feature a spot from my friends at Sweet Child of Time. Check out that podcast for sure. But do more than that. Leave a review on Apple iTunes. Really, any review makes a big difference, and I'm sure my friends at Sweet Child of Time will appreciate that. Without further ado, here is Professor Philip Haberkern. How have you been?
I am good, thank you. How about yourself?
Pretty good. You're teaching a Game of Thrones class right now, is that right?
No, I'm out of sequence for my thronesiness right now, so I'm teaching a Reformation class is my undergrad course this semester.
I see. So that must have been last semester, maybe?
Last semester I taught it, and I'll do it again next fall.
Do you incorporate any television adaptations, House of the Dragon, anything like that? Or is it mostly focused on book material?
It's equally book, and we do a fair amount of the TV season, but it's only first book, first season.
Right.
So it's limited temporally, but we do a lot of in-class activities with watching scenes in class and sort of reflecting on them. So I think it's good for the students, I think, to see it and to sort of, I don't know, read the room and the dynamics in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet Child of Time is a podcast that has recapped every episode of 1899, Dark, and The Wheel of Time. And we will be recapping Season 3 of Wheel of Time as it airs. Join me, Steve Barnes of the band Introvoid, and my roster of co-hosts, including film critic Lindsay Dunn, as we recap our favorite TV shows and movies related to time, including Time Bandits, Death Clock, and more. Sweet Child of Time on Spotify, Apple, everywhere podcasts are. Check us out, Sweet Child of Time.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
I don't know if we've covered a John chapter yet, have we?
We have not.
Are you a fan of Jon Snow?
I have extremely mixed feelings about Jon Snow.
I mean, he is kind of one of these characters that some people just find boring and other people are in love with. Anyway, I'm curious to hear your impression.
I mean, I think Jon Snow... the continuation of the books into the show and the way his story evolves and wraps up, no matter how you feel about it, makes me go back to these early books, and his are the chapters that I find myself rereading most carefully to try to find what I missed the first couple of times through.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the end of Usual Suspects. Where you go back and you see, you're like, oh, why didn't I pick that up? Right. Why didn't I see how this is all, you know, coming to reveal the identity of Kazri Soze? And so I find myself more interested in John now than I was in the moment. And that's actually kind of a lot of fun.
Yeah. I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I'm kind of ashamed to say that when I first went through Clash, I would skip the John and Bran chapters. And it was a very foolish decision, but I was so interested in what was going on elsewhere in the book.
Right.
And I wanted to just kind of blow through it, and I just thought, this is just so boring. And then, of course, you know, in my second read, all of that stuff was the most interesting part of the book.
Was your second read after watching the show, or was it still prior to the revelation?
No, yeah, that's right. I think I read this book in between season one and season two, so that was 2011 or something like that.
Okay.
I think I read the entire series in between season one and season two, but... The second read was sort of like on a Christmas break where I sort of like could carefully reread a few of these chapters. And a few of these chapters are like, oh, of course, that's why that happened. So these are the most rewarding for me on reread. And of course, this is the chapter where we meet Ygritte for the first time.
Which oh, my is gosh.
Such an important character for John's story. And kind of, I don't know if it's the beginning of his seduction to, or his, you know, not seduction, but literally falling in love with free folk culture.
Yes.
And she kind of is that voice in this chapter, like, north and south, it kind of depends on where you're standing.
Oh, that's such a great, it's a great line. But then the idea that Martin also pauses to show that it has an impact, like a lock clicking into place inside of Jon Snow, feels very telling. I also, though, even now, I kind of still skip the Bran chapters in this book. So I don't hold you. I don't judge you for that at all.
Sure.
And for me, the other one is Theon. That's not my jam. So
the most interesting thing about Dance of Dragons is Bran's encounter with Bloodraven under the big white tree. And to me, that's just candy. And so kind of going back to the Bran chapters, you're really getting an introduction to that magical world. So I am interested in that part.
Okay.
Do you like magical stories? Is that your jam? Or is this kind of, do you come to these books because you're a historian and that's kind of your interest in these books?
No, I mean, like epic fantasy is like my go-to pleasure read genre. It always has been. And so I came to these books as a fantasy fan first. And again, I read these as they came out, eagerly awaiting them from the first one on. And so the magical elements.
You were reading this stuff back in the early aughts.
Oh, when did the first one came out? I was in college.
I think this one came out in 96. Clash came out.
I remember buying Game of Thrones in the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill student bookstore. It had like a fiction section as well. And buying it and reading it. And then just the key to me was just how it took all of the things I loved about that genre and gave it this like hard, thoughtful, difficult edge in a way that some other books hadn't. And so for me, it was the additive of political thriller to, you know, the more traditional sort of fantastical elements that was just catnip. It was an incredible combination. And, you know, I think a lot of people have shared this, but there are moments where Martin sets you up with how a story is supposed to play out in terms of the fantasy genre and all of its conventions. And then he subverts it at the last second where I literally felt my jaw drop, you know, for the Red Wedding or for what happens to Eddard Stark. And so like those are moments of just pure shock. It's delightful. It's wonderful. So yes, I like the magical elements. And I think what's, again, one of the things that he's so successful at as an author is tempering those so they never overwhelm the other sides of the story. And it's the balance he strikes that I find just, it's really good. It's really, really, really good.
When I was first reading these books, I was talking with a friend of mine who'd already read them. And he's like, reading those books is kind of like you're bracing yourself for an axe to the forehead. Like you're just sitting there thinking, I know that I'm going to get an axe to the forehead. And while you're bracing yourself for that, you realize like someone's, you know, got a hacksaw at your ankle. You know, that's, it's like, I wasn't expecting that, you know.
Yeah.
I knew it was going to be bad, but I didn't expect it to be that, you know, bad like this. Anyway, I thought that was a nice little metaphor.
You know, the only other sort of story show that I ever felt so much dread while at the same time taking immense pleasure in it was The Wire on HBO. Just knowing that these people I come to care deeply about, as you say, I know something bad is going to happen, but I don't know exactly when or how. And you feel this sense of palpable dread, but you can't look away. It's an achievement. That's for sure.
All right, so we're looking at a Jon chapter today. Let me read my synopsis. Traveling by stealth, along the Skirling Pass. Corrin and his scouts see a campfire 2,000 feet up the Frostfangs. They surmise that it is a couple watchers spying the pass for Mance. Stone Snake and Jon Snow volunteer to hike and climb up to kill them. After a long and dangerous climb, Jon kills his first wildling and then finds that a girl is among them. With a dagger at her throat, she yields, and Jon takes her as his captive. Her name is Ygritte, and she tells Jon that Mance has gathered 100,000 or more free folk. Corrin returns and tells Jon that they can't bring any captives and goes on ahead. Alone, Jon decides to free Ygritte instead of killing her. So, Phil Habergren, what do you want to talk about today?
I mean, we have to start with Ygritte, don't we? I mean, she's amazing. Again, in some ways, a character out of a lot of tropes, fantasy literature, this wild woman who seduces or entrances, you know, the man who is sort of a voice or an avatar of civilization. And yet every line she speaks is just amazing. She's so developed immediately as a character, this fully fleshed out person and equal. I don't know. It's unexpected and marvelous.
Some tropes, when done really well, work every time, right?
Yes.
And here we have, maybe I'll take back something I said before. She is, in some ways, John's introduction to wildling culture. However, you do get the sense with Corrin that he has an appreciation for the free folk as adversaries in a way that other characters in the story don't. Like, a lot of these Night's Watchmen, they're dismissive. They're like, these guys are, they're savages. They can't organize themselves. They're less human. But
yes,
you don't get the sense with Corrin that that's his view of them. And so Corrin kind of has a little bit of impact on Jon, I think, first off, but in no way, shape, or form is he going to be able to accomplish what Ygritte does, because Jon is a teenage boy. And he probably hasn't seen a woman in months.
Potentially.
And so, of course, he's going to look at her differently. As a result, he's going to develop a little bit of compassion for the free folk.
Yes, but I was so struck, because this is one of those moments where I do think the dialogue between the show and the book, and particularly the actor who plays Ygritte, is so striking that that's the image, at least I have in my head. But right, when you get the first description of Ygritte in the book, maybe as old as 20, short for her age, bandy-legged with a round face, small hands, and a pug nose.
Right.
Shaggy mop of red hair stuck out in all directions. Like, there is nothing there that says attractive. You know, right.
There's two things.
Seen a woman in 6 months.
Right, right. Yeah. There's two things that make you, that make me think, I wonder if he's attracted to her, like, immediately. And the first thing is, there's something about her that reminds him of Arya.
Yes.
And in the very early stages of writing Game of Thrones, Martin has this idea that he's eventually going to get Arya and Jon together.
That tracks.
Right. So there's a little bit of Arya here. She doesn't really look like Arya, but she reminds me of Arya. And then he's like studying her and he's thinking she might be pretty skinny under all those clothes. So he's imagining her naked. So it doesn't come out and say it, and you know, maybe John's maybe he's too honorable to, you know, let his mind go there consciously. But those two little things make me think there's something here. There's an immediate something here.
Yes, I guess for me though, it's almost like by not immediately, you know, talking about her as this striking or beautiful young woman, it's really once she starts talking that I think John finds himself like irresistibly drawn to her. And I think that, and again, she is sharing this sort of wonderful story of wildling culture and this idea of exposing John to all the things he doesn't know about this place that he thought he understood. That for me, it's almost like she needs to be a little bit, plain's not the right word, but less than striking and gorgeous, so we pay attention to what she's saying and how she's acting. I don't know, because that to me is the, as you mentioned earlier, she is seductive to John. And yes, we know that is ultimately physically true, but here it's the pull of the words and the culture and the ideas as much as, if not more than, the physical. But I don't know, maybe that's, I'm putting too much into it.
No, there's something there. There's something to that. And, you know, he makes her smile a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And she's more brave than he expects her to be. So there's something about, they're impressing each other. There's some chemistry here that's maybe not just physical. So that's a good point. It's a good point. All right. So I kind of want to talk a little bit about her take on kind of her relationship to the first men.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a blurring of cultural lines here in a few ways in this chapter, but she seems to be better aware of this than he is.
Oh yes.
So I think that she views the wall as like, well, that wall there just is between the first men that occupied the South mm-hmm. and the first men that occupied the North. And you and I might be distant cousins for all I know. Of course, it's sort of packaged in this mythological story with Bale the Bard, but that is sort of, that story's true in a sense mm-hmm. that both the Starks and the people north of the wall all descend from the same people way, way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So the story might be a myth, and yet it conveys something that's really, really true that Ygritte knows and John does not yet know.
When last semester, when I was teaching my course on Game of Thrones, we actually read this really interesting article on border studies and Hadrian's Wall, and there's some slight references to Game of Thrones as well in there. Mm-hmm. And this idea of the sort of psychological significance of physical boundaries that cut off cultural, linguistic, historical unities, but impose a new reality simply through their existence. And, you know, we were reading this because we were talking about the Wall and the North, and we weren't up to Ygritte yet because we were only in the first book. But again, this idea of a shared cultural, historical space being divided and then that taking on significance over time, I think is really meaningful here. And, you know, as you say, she is seeing all of these linkages,
mm-hmm.
even as John can't quite do that yet. And yet, within the span of one story, she's opening him up to this potential. And whether it actually happened or not, I'm going to choose to believe it did. I think it's amazing, like how quickly you see that kind of building of or recognition of the resonance of that kind of a story.
It's amazing to me how quickly that kind of stuff can take hold. Because, like, I was thinking about like Rwanda. So like the colonized history of Rwanda is that when the colonists come in, they start pointing out the different phenotypes of the different kinds of native Rwandans didn't place any value on their physical differences, you know, whether they were more light-skinned or dark-skinned or taller or shorter or whatever. But it's almost like those were imposed upon the Rwandans by the colonists, and then those became really important distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that, like, it's not a physical wall, but these are physical things that you hadn't noticed before, and just generating massive amounts of animosity.
Yes.
So sometimes I think, you know, the wall is kind of the roughest and, you know, most unnuanced version of this, this kind of reality. But those things take hold so quickly and can be so important.
Yes. And I mean, here we have one of those artificial distinctions that's now hundreds and thousands of years old. And so it's all of those categories have sort of hardened, except the more we learn, you know, we see that the free folk are able to pass by and through that wall in surprising numbers. And this boundary, cultural, physical, geographical, that we thought was impermeable is in fact more fluid than we expected. And then you get into the idea of these, you know, cultural regions that are kind of hybrid by nature around borders and these sort of boundaries, and things become much more interesting. And again, this is something that Ygritte and her people know.
Right.
But I think as soon as it's spoken, you know, John and Corin, I think you're right, is also in a similar boat. He recognizes his similarities to these people he's supposed to be hunting and hating. And maybe even Stone Snake. It's harder to say. We don't get as much of a read on him. He's a little bit of a cipher, but you suspect that any of the rangers who survived north of the wall feel a sense of identity almost with these people because they've survived the same challenges.
Right. And so it would make sense that some of that kind of social commentary will make its way into the stories that they tell each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the story that we get in this is that, you know, Ygritte says something along the lines of, you know, we're probably related. And John's like, what are you talking about? He's like, didn't you have a mother who told you the story of the Winter Rose? And he's like, tell me the story. And, you know, he presses her a bit and she tells him the story. And the story is that there was a king beyond the wall and his name was Bael the Bard. And Ygritte's a little bit like, you know, she doesn't totally believe this story, but she recognizes it as just a good song, which probably does convey a certain amount of truth, but she's not buying the thing wholesale. So the story goes basically that this guy, Bael the Bard, was king beyond the wall, and the Stark in Winterfell hated him because he could never capture him. And he said something very nasty about the guy, called him Craven or something. So Bael scaled the wall, skipped down the King's Road, gave himself a new name, which means deceiver in the tongue of the old men. And he pretends to be a traveling singer. And he you know, he sups with the Starks at table. And the Brandon Stark, we don't know which one, loves the song so much that he says, you can choose anything. Just name it. I'll give you anything, you know, within my power. And he chooses this very rare blue flower. And so when they go to get the flower and give it to him, this guy's gone, but so's Brandon's daughter. And they can't find the two anywhere. Well, anyway, what ends up happening is those two have fallen in love and are living in the crypts of Winterfell. For I don't know how long, but it's a story, so let's not worry about that.
9 months and a day.
Yeah, right. Sure. He ends up returning the girl to her bed, but in payment for the rose that they were going to give him, he's returned her with his child, who's going to become the next king of Winterfell. And so, in other words, the whole story is meant to tell us that even the Lord of Winterfell has wildling blood in his veins because he's a descendant of Bael the Bard. And there's a few other things I think we can glean from the story, but I do think that that is the kind of story that would be meaningful to free folk because it reminds them that the people south of the wall are no better than they are. Or at least, or maybe the view is like, maybe we got something over on them. You know, maybe they think that they're better than us. But in reality, one of ours snuck in and became the king of Winterfell. I don't know. What is your take on this story?
I mean, so we'll put aside the Winter Rose and the sort of potentially prophetic elements for now, if that's mm-hmm. okay. Because I mean, this is the kind of story of like the trickster who comes in. Here there's no sense of it as a divine figure, but as, you know, this eminently human figure who comes in and, you know, effectively cuckolds the Lord of yep. Winterfell and takes his most precious thing. And as you say, you know, there's the humor in the story, right? Like, this is a funny story.
Right.
And if you're telling it around a free folk fire, you know, it's a good story because, as you say, it affirms your equality to, or even superiority to, these Southerners who think right. they're Northerners, who think they're better than you. That's all, like, that's all fine. But there's also then the tragic ending of the story where the son kills the father and then the mother commits suicide when she sees the result of this. Now we're tapping into, you know, Oedipal.
Yeah. This is archetype. It almost went from like a Norse trickster story to like a Greek tragedy
in a heartbeat. And, you know, therein is the lesson too, that it's because the Starks can't recognize their kinship with the North, you have this incredibly tragic outcome. Uh-huh. And then we might read this as prophetic as well, where the son doesn't long outlive her. One of his lords peeled the skin off him and wore him for a cloak. So I guess we shouldn't trust the Boltons. Right. So it's the way it moves through. I mean, it brings in, again, all of these really recognizable cultural archetypes from across the world
yeah.
and encodes it in this really fun story, you know, for the fireside. And so I think it's a really amazing bit of, it is her commentary, but it's obscured in a story that is at once sort of affirming of the, it is both affirming of the free folk, but it also suggests that their end will always be tragic.
Yeah. All right. I want to talk about the Winter Rose,
because
just recently there was in the House of Undyne, Dany sees a blue flower that grows out of a crack in the ice wall, right?
Yes.
And I think a lot of fans are sort of very enamored with this idea that this is the blue rose is representative of Lyanna Stark. And interestingly enough, the little story told about Brandon's daughter
mm-hmm.
has a few parallels with maybe Lyanna's story.
Yes, the musically inclined mm-hmm. Figure who should not be allowed to marry a Stark, or, you know, have or father a child with a Stark. I think I've heard that story before.
Yeah, like here we have this Stark daughter, and we've got, you know, a little bit of forbidden fruit happening. Mm-hmm. You know, falls in love and stolen away, and produces a child who will grow up to be a lord or a king, mm-hmm. even, whose parentage is somewhat of a mystery, right? That's all kind of, all of this kind of stuff parallels what we think will happen with Jon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here we have Jon sitting there at a campfire, hearing the story told to him, a story he's never heard before, in a chapter where we are reminded that he doesn't really know who his mother is.
Yes.
So do you think that this is just a literary flourish? Or do you think that this is something that will help us? Is this meant to be a clue for us?
Again, in retrospect, yes, certainly. When I first or second time read this, did I pick up on this and think through it? Absolutely not. But it feels there are too many resonances here, and particularly yeah. coming off that the House of the Undying chapter, which is what, like 3 or 4 chapters before this.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like a moment where maybe, you know, Martin as an author is thinking through that like ambiguous prophetic plan for the prince who is promised. And again, I was 100% insensible to this. You weren't even reading the chapter, but
absolutely skipping this part.
But it, I mean, it's, this is one where you go back and you're like, oh, that's really, that's really clever, you know, and that is just enough echoes that it feels undeniable in this particular case.
So are you familiar with the phrase, the three-stage Martin reveal?
Enlighten me.
Okay. So what George Martin will do is he will, if he wants to reveal a mystery, he'll start with a tiny little obscure hint of a clue that he thinks almost no one will pick up on. And then later on in the story, he'll do the reveal, but he won't like hit you over the head with it. So okay. It's like, oh, yeah, that actually makes sense. Now I get it. Jon Snow's, you know, Lyanna is actually Jon Snow's mother. But he won't come out and say it. He'll talk around it. So most fans will catch it there. But if you really need to be hit over the head with it, much later in the story, someone will say it in plain language. This is a kind of a three-stage pattern that he goes through with a lot of little revealed mysteries. I think that this is step one or clue one of this three-stage Martin reveal. That's my sense. Because I, like you said, upon first read, you just don't have enough evidence at this point. But in retrospect, you think, oh, yeah, he's laying some groundwork for this.
Oh, that's it. I mean, now I feel less bad that I didn't pick up on it, that it's only stage one.
So that's, I'm sure that's someone really will email me and say, actually, stage one was in book one because
I'm sure the crown of love and beauty, or whatever, the queen of love and beauty at the tourney is vaguely referenced. No, it's a great way to do it. And again, because as we were talking about this idea that the primary action or the primary revelation here is the shared identity of the free folk and the people of the North, right? So the focus, and it's also, I think, very immediately on the chemistry between Ygritte and John disobeying a direct order to kill her, and his sort of first betrayal, well, not his first, but yet another betrayal of the Night's Watch. On his part, or attempted betrayal. So that's what draws the eye, and that is important. And we're starting to see the sort of evolution of him, and then also, you know, the character of Corin as a sort of enabler in that process. All of that is so important and immediate that it occupies our attention. So then there is this sort of prophetic lore-based level that he can sort of, you know, tuck into the corner for us to return to later. And say, oh, I really should have seen that. You know, I should have seen that detail and filed it away.
I think to me, these are the most interesting things about this pass, this chapter.
Oh, yeah.
Was there anything else about this that you want to talk about?
I mean, I find it interesting how Ygritte's response to Ghost. Because, you know, she's someone who has seen and talked with giants and has knows that the dead return if you don't burn them or if they're not eaten by shadow cats. Like, she has seen wonders and horrors. And yet, even for her, a tame dire wolf is a shocking thing. And so I think this is one of those places where we do get a sense of how radically the world is changing and like how things never seen before are coming to pass.
Right.
And so we see it from her, which I think is really, because again, she's being built up as this uncommonly brave, strong, clever person. And yet Ghost is terrifying to her.
Yeah. I mean, she has a few, I mean, she's been around wargs, like someone, the guy that John just killed is a warg.
Why do we know that he's a warg?
Later on, she tells him, she's like,
that's right.
Why is that eagle looking at me weird? She's like, well, that eagle used to be a man. You killed him.
Oh my gosh, that's right.
It's like two John chapters in the future. So the first guy that he kills is this guy Oral, or Orel.
No,
or,
that's right.
Anyway, so she's been around wargs, but they're warging into like eagles and shadow cats. A big old wolf probably scare anyone. I mean,
do you think she's also responding to the fact that John doesn't seem to know what he is?
Move closer to the mic and say that.
Sorry, I was leaning back contemplatively in my chair. Do you think she's also responding to the fact that she recognizes that John does not know what he is? It doesn't recognize his relationship with Ghost as anything supernatural.
It's interesting. They don't really have that conversation. So I don't know what she knows, what she thinks he knows and doesn't know.
Well, I guess I'm just saying, because, you know, she sees the interaction where they're like basically playing tug the way I would with my dog. And she seems so, again, like just weirded out by this interaction that I'm guessing she understands that like this is not how it normally looks.
Interesting.
And it's something else.
Here's another theory. Again, tinfoil.
Is it some sort of shorthand for the show that I'm allowed to just say tinfoil and then I can say any crazy sort of fan theory that I like?
Now you're getting it.
Excellent.
Starks are associated with wolves in a way that no other family is.
Mm-hmm.
So is it possible that the Stark kids are uniquely qualified to connect with dire wolves, whereas, you know, people up north would more readily, you know, connect with some other kind of animal? I don't know. So maybe the reason why she's never seen a dire wolf act this way is because she's never actually met a Stark before.
I mean, I think that would be this falls into the realm of like that seems entirely plausible to me.
Yeah.
And I will admit, give quite like I'm okay not being sure about this, you know, just unique to this generation of Starks. Is it because of the comet? Is it because of the reawakening of magic?
Uh-huh.
Is it because of this, you know, genealogical link between direwolves and Starks? And I would just kind of say, sure. that all sounds good. Yeah. Take your pick. So that's kind of where I come down. But it is striking to me of like, again, this idea of like, she seems to know more. Ygritte knows more about John than he knows about himself.
Right. Yeah.
From a very early stage, which that's again true. Is so crucial to the way their relationship evolves over time.
Yeah. He knows nothing, Jon Snow.
yes.
With that in mind, why does she, once she hears John's name, why does she recoil and say an evil name?
Evil name.
Like that, to me, that caught my attention. An evil name?
And then he says what? It's a bastard's name.
Right. It's almost as if she's talking not for herself, but for the meta narrative. Like, I recognize that name as false. That's not who you really are. I don't know, but evil is a weird way to frame it.
Yeah, that's hard to... I noticed that on this reread, and I didn't know, is there some sort of... Does that have a meaning north of the wall that it's lost south of the wall? But it feels like that would deserve explanation. The recognition that it's false makes a lot of sense because so much of this, there is the subtext in this chapter of who John really is, but why an evil name?
Yeah, it's an odd one. And I don't get any, we don't really get any explanation of this later on. So it does make me wonder, like, is there like a cultural misfire here, you know, where a word in your culture means something entirely different in my culture? On the surface, I think that that's kind of how I have to read it. But I do think that there's something going on, like there's some visceral reaction to like, no, that's not that's not a real name. That's how a about, false name.
How about a recognition maybe that she does know what it means, and that the idea of singling out people of illegitimate birth and understanding the consequences of that is the evil. That it's not that John Snow is evil, but the idea that you would give people this name to know who's illegitimate and marginalize them, that's the evil. Because she talks about, you know, the idea of family identity certainly seems much more fluid in freefolk culture, and how you fit in the ideas of these, you know, carefully guarded lineages seems pretty anathema to them. So perhaps it's that.
You know what? That's why they pay you the big bucks.
I wish they did. That would be sweet.
I do. I think I like that answer better than mine.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, she knows enough about Winterfell's lore to know, you know, that there are Brandon Starks and whatnot, right?
Oh my gosh.
So she must know. Yeah, so many Brandons. She must know what snow means. She must know that, oh, that's what they name bastards. And what an evil tradition to do that to someone.
Because it's interesting, because she says that initially, but afterwards, you know, she typically calls him Jon Snow. And so there, it's not that she's afraid to use, it's not like it's a cursed word in terms of the way she interacts with him later. But it is that moment of seeing, I don't know. It's a possibility.
Yeah. No, that's how he responds. He said he responds by saying it's a bastard's name.
Mm-hmm.
And then he like volunteers that my dad is the Lord of Winterfell. And then Stone Snake says, you know, usually the interrogation goes the other way. You're not supposed to just volunteer information to the person you just took captive.
It's so good. It's so good that. And I do appreciate that, like, again, like over and over with John, he's capable of this climb. You know, he does 75% of the deed he's assigned to do. And so there is competence, you know, like he is a capable warrior ranger. Mm-hmm. And yet you keep having these people put him in his place. Again, it's just, he knows nothing. And over and over is reminded of that in these delightful little ways.
We were talking about chaos earlier. There's something interesting to me about, okay, here's this guy. This guy's been training for battle his whole life. You know, ever since he could hold a stick as a young man, they've been teaching him how to sword fight. And he's finally in a position where he's going to actually have to kill a man. And what does it look like? It has nothing to do with armor. It has nothing to do with who's a better swordsman. It's about sneaking up in the dark and fighting someone who's not even holding a sword. He's holding a firebrand. And then, you know, quickly putting a dagger to a girl's throat. It's this. It kind of gives you the image that, like, there's nothing noble about this. The battlefield is chaotic, and it doesn't look the way that it looks in, you know, when you're training at arms.
Wouldn't you call that, though, one of the central, I mean, like, that to me is one of the central thematic, is the deromanticization of violence. It seems to me to be, like, more than anything, Martin wants us to understand, you know, that battle is.
I think it is a major consideration for him. And I think it probably stems out of, you know, the Vietnam generation. You know, so something about that, like, let's retell a fantasy story, but in a way that does not glamorize warfare.
Yes,
you know, it's all about it's all treachery, it's all evil, it's all sneaking up on, really, your distant cousin in the dark. You know, that's what this is about.
And random, right? We can't forget that it's also like who lives and dies over and over feels quite arbitrary, even when we know it's not, because this is literature, right? Like Martin does choose who lives and dies in any given encounter, but manages to depict the overall, you know, that this world is governed largely by chance. I will also say, just one more sort of thing is there is the aside in the initial attack of admiration for the guy who goes for his horn instead of his sword.
Yeah, John Hus is that's brave. That guy is more worried about doing his duty for the larger community than he is about his own life. He knows going for the horn instead of going for the weapon is an act of altruism.
It is. And so one more thing, you know, again, is we're sowing the seeds here of how John understands Free Folk Society and sort of what there is admirable. So it's, wow. Yeah. There's a lot here, I think, in terms of unpacking the recognition that these things he's been bred to believe are cultural differences are in fact cultural similarities. And you could probably even make at some point a large argument that really the Night's Watch as an entity is so much more similar. Like they are free folk. They just happen to live at the exact border between free folk culture and the Seven Kingdoms. But when you think about their codes of honor, their behavior, what they're tasked to do, even their backgrounds, like the Night's Watch has way more in common with the free folk than they do with Winterfell.
It's funny, like you were talking about The Wire, the show The Wire. I almost get the sense that like after watching a show like that, or I don't know if you saw it most recently, Simon did this show called We Own the City or We Own the... What was it called?
Yes. I think it's... I can't remember, but I'm familiar with it.
All right. Anyway, after one of those shows like The Wire, you get the sense that, you know, the cops and the robbers have a lot more in common than you would imagine. Like the cops act a lot more like a gang than they should. And there's a lot more honor among thieves than you would expect.
Yes.
And that to me, that this chapter is kind of reminding us, or at least kind of forcing us to question, like, who's actually noble here? Mm-hmm. Who's doing the honorable thing here? You know, at the end, I kind of feel like, how can you not side with the free folk, given the larger trajectory of the narrative?
I mean, it's an interesting one because I would have to give it a lot more thought. And I think there are individuals within the free folk who might make us question this. But I do think overall they remain sympathetic figures, honorable, responding to this, you know, irresistible force pushing them out of their lives and kind of consistently seeking the greater good. I don't know. Again, this is just coming to me in the course of the conversation, so I'd have to think more about it. But it feels like that's not a position that Martin changes much on.
Mm. He will introduce a few people like Craster who are just moral monsters, right?
Again, but is Craster a true – he's not a true free folk because he collaborates with the Night's Watch. You know, like he is, I think, the unhealthy hybrid figure who is the sort of dealer, you know, intermediary between the two worlds. But no, you're right. Craster, no doubt. There are.
I mean, you got Thens. Everyone hates Thens, right?
Yeah. I'm just saying overall.
I get what you're saying. And I think that there's something about the various clans coming together for a greater good.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most noble thing, like putting aside differences because, you know, we might have been historic enemies, but we need to come together to fight the Nazis or whatever it is.
Right. And this is the fundamental contrast with Westeros, where they can never do that. They never succeed in putting aside those differences, even when, you know, they're presented with evidence that things are not right in the world. And so, you know, I think that comparison is we're meant to make it. And here we see John as the bridging figure between the two.
Yeah.
For the first time, starting to become that.
Yeah, that's very well said. Notable introductions in this chapter. We meet Squire Dalbridge. He was a squire to a king at one point. I imagine some Targaryen you know, pre-Baratheon king.
Mm-hmm.
And the title squire just stuck with them. Eben, Stonesnake, who's a good climber, and of course, introduction to Ygritte, very important character.
Yes.
Departure. Well, the two other watchers that were with Ygritte, we say goodbye to them. And show differences. I don't think we hear anything about Bale the Bard in the show, which is, to me, a really, enormous. Really crucial element in this chapter.
Oh, that's just kind of mean.
Well, what they and what here's what they do. What they do is they repurpose that story for Mance Rayder, who claims mm-hmm. that he snuck in to one of Ned's feasts.
Yes, yes, yes.
And of course, later in the books, Mance has claims to have done something along those lines. But anyway, no story about Bale the Bard.
That really feels quite deliberate then, in terms of like having that bigger picture sense of the prophetic arc and deliberately withholding it
mm-hmm.
because it would have felt too easy in some ways. That's interesting.
I don't know. Is it one of those things where, like, well, we want to protect the mystery, or is it just like we need a narrative shorthand here?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe on screen it might be better to have Ygritte like spoon John for warmth and have him be all right. upset about it. you know, visually that's more interesting.
It is. I'm just trying to remember. In the show, do they have anything about the blue rose in the wall of ice? Is that depicted as well from the House of the Undying episode?
If it is, I remember nothing about it.
Okay.
I mean, the House of the Undying episode basically has like Drogo and a burnt down throne room. Great Hall in King's Landing.
Mm.
I do not think that there's anything about the blue flower.
All right. So they're carefully weeding out references to the mm-hmm. winter rose.
You got it.
Fascinating. All right. Now I'm feeling tinfoily.
Very, very good. Phil, what a delight. Thank you so much.
It's always my pleasure, I assure you. It's fun to get back into this world and spend entirely too much time thinking about it.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
S. Dorsey Armstrong is a professor at Purdue University. She is the executive editor of Arthuriana. You can find that journal at arthuriana.com. She's also done her own translation of the Winchester manuscript. Do a search for Dorsey Armstrong Mort D'Arthur to find that. If you have a question for me or an expert on medieval life and literature, send that to book@baldmove.com. It's from Anonymous. Anonymous asks this. He says, George Martin likes to create characters who have historical analogs. In fact, sometimes he creates composite characters who show parallels with multiple historical figures. But seemingly Jon Snow has none. In a previous podcast, you or a guest suggested that the best analog for Jon is literary, King Arthur. But aside from being a boy with a claim to the throne, what are the points of similarity? Now, I have a few ideas here, but I was wondering if you saw any similarities between Arthur and Jon.
That is a fantastic question that both points to how Martin in his work is using sources, especially from the medieval world. He has read extensively and done extensive research into both medieval history and medieval literature. But at the same time, the question gets to the fact that Jon Snow is not necessarily clearly an analog of this character or that character. The way he is like Arthur would be especially in terms of the mystery surrounding his birth and his upbringing. In several of the legends, after Arthur is conceived, Merlin comes and takes the child away to be raised in secret. And so no one knows what has become of the heir to the throne. He himself does not know for a very long time who he is. In fact, in Malory's text in particular, he is raised as the foster son of Sir Ector, and Sir Kay, he believes, is his older brother.
Uh-huh.
And so there is this moment when he discovers he is in fact the king, where you can imagine poor Sir Kay is like, what do you mean? My annoying little foster brother, not even my blood brother.
Mm-hmm.
I now have to kneel to him. You know, I've been giving him a hard time. He has to carry my sword and my boots and all this. And no, he's actually the king. And so in that sense, it is very Arthurian that his identity is, it's hidden in part to protect him.
Yeah.
Because there are many claimants to the throne.
Yeah, and the king of the realm is hidden in plain sight, basically.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And being fostered in an unlikely house.
Right. And Game of Thrones does that. He is the bastard son, supposedly, of Ned Stark.
Right.
And poor Ned Stark's long-suffering wife, he comes home from war and is like, here is my bastard son. Take care of him with our other children. And it can't even reveal to her that, in fact, he has not betrayed his vows to his wife, but that he has taken an oath to protect this child. And the only way he can do it is by deceiving everyone, including her.
Right. Yeah, I would say, so I really like that. That's very helpful to me. I think we have to wait and to see what Martin does with this prophecy called the Azor Ahai prophecy, which is sort of way in the background.
Yes, all of us are waiting.
Book lore, right?
We're waiting with bated breath to see if that's something's going to come out there.
Right. But you get a little bit there, you know, the ancient warrior king held back the darkness, magic sword, but maybe we'll come again. And to me, that's the most interesting part because, you know, maybe we could talk a little bit about the expectation for, you know, the king who was once great, who will return.
Yes. And that is one of the, you know, most enduring and, you know, sort of engaging aspects of the Arthurian legend is this hope that he will come again. And in many tales, we don't actually see him die. We see him wounded. He gets taken away to be healed. And we don't know what happens. And the story is that he'll come again when Britain needs him. And some of your listeners, probably some of them know.
How early is that expectation?
So that's Geoffrey of Monmouth. I mean, there's the sort of, he's taken away to be healed.
Got it.
But, you know, as late as in World War II, there were all sorts of movies made in Britain with this sort of theme of Arthur's going to come back and help us fight the Nazis. I'm not kidding. I mean, or it's World War II. We're fighting the Nazis. Oh, look, we found Excalibur. And now Excalibur is going to help us fight the Nazis.
Sure.
And, you know, archaeologists doing digs in various parts of Britain, especially in the early part of the 20th century, would tell stories about how locals absolutely believed that the king was asleep somewhere in the Hollow Hills. So they'd say to the archaeologist, oh, are you looking for the king? And archaeologists say, what do you mean? You're excavating, you're digging. King's asleep in the cave. Are you going to wake him up?
Hmm.
And that it was a legitimate belief that this savior figure was waiting to come again in the hour of greatest need.
That's so interesting.
And I think that, you know, one reason the legend remains popular to this day is if you just take a look around you, I'd be really happy if an Arthur figure came back and took over and set things to rights.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the fantasy that we all have that there will be a figure who appears and will just fix it for us.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of Jon Snow, I kind of feel like there aren't a lot of parallels. It depends on if there is a fleshing out of this former king who reemerges to save Westeros or something like that, which is not impossible.
Right.